So Puerto Rico's income tax, do you know what it is?
Yeah. Probably zero.
It's 4%. It's 4%.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
They have no capital gains tax treatment, zero. There's no federal, there's no state, it's just nothing. And I was like, holy crap. Like, I might have to look at technically putting my domicile in like Puerto Rico just for those capital gains taxes in the future. Like, that's incredible. Zero.
Well, do you have to, you would have to basically give up your US citizenship for that, right?
I don't think they did. No, I think you just basically, I don't know exactly how it works, to be honest. Maybe I can look it up real
Because
quick.
like why wouldn't you be taxed at the IRS federal rate? Right?
I don't know. I mean, it is technically, yeah, territory of the US.
Wait, Greg, are we like is this part of the episode?
I don't know. I don't know. We're just talking. I mean, maybe it'll get in there, but
Okay. No,
yeah, US
Greg, like
citizens
I'm
who
pretty sure.
become
Yeah.
bona fide residents of Puerto Rico can maintain their US citizenship, avoid US federal tax income tax on capital gains, including US sourced capital gains, and avoid paying any income tax on interest and dividends from Puerto Rican sources. Like, why isn't that more of a topic?
But Greg, let me ask you a question. There's obviously a lot of really wealthy people that live in New York City and California, right? Why are just about not all of these people thinking about, at the very least, moving down to like a Florida or a Texas or some other no state income tax state, right? Is it
I think
just
some
that
of them
people?
are. No, think about it. So I know plenty of people that are the snowbird type, right? So they live in New York or they live in Boston and then they go down for the winter in Florida. I can guarantee you 90 plus percent of those people that live in two different places, they're choosing Florida as their actual primary home for the tax purposes. Guarantee it. I know of one venture capitalist that definitely does that. They split time between New York and Florida. Their home address is in Florida, even though maybe they spend a little bit more time in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, I think my point here is that like not everybody constructs their life around tax situations, right? There's other things to consider too, right? Where are your friends and family located? What school district are your kids in? There's a bunch of other things that are there too. And I do think that like the idea of moving to Puerto Rico is probably a pretty big step for a lot of people, especially I mean we're running a physician syndicate podcast here, right? So like if you're working at a hospital, let's say at NYU, and you're really enjoying it there, right? Is it really worth giving up practicing medicine to move down to Puerto Rico to save money on income tax, where your money is, where you won't even be making that much income in Puerto Rico as you were in NYU? And I don't know, it just gets a little bit messy.
I think for any normal person, I think you're completely right. Like, you wouldn't restructure your entire life to avoid taxes. However, I think there are people that it makes complete sense for, right? So, with the sale of our business, I was talking to Lauren about this. Had we moved down to Puerto Rico as soon as we knew we were going to sell the company and switch over our, domicile to Puerto Rico, we would have saved millions of dollars, legitimately millions of dollars. Had we done that, had we known that, and I would have seriously considered it, like even if it was for a couple years to avoid a capital gains tax bill on a very large sum of money, for sure.
Yeah, I think that there are some small changes that people can make to really make a dent in their tax situation that can have a meaningful impact on their lives, right? So Greg, a lot of times we talk about short-term versus long-term taxes. Do you want to talk about the difference there and what the tax treat how the tax treatment is different for the IRS?
Yeah, now that we're getting back to the actual topic that we wanted to talk about and not Puerto Rico, even though we might have to do an entire episode on Puerto Rico and bring the people on that I had spoken to about it, because it's a super interesting topic in my mind about how you can structure your life. But yeah, going back to the tax treatment, specifically within the angel investing venture capital world, right? That's like what ultimately this episode is supposed to be about. So there's two types of capital gains tax treatments. There's the short-term capital gains tax treatment, and there's a long-term capital gains tax treatment. So the definition, I think, for the you know, slider between going from a short-term to a long-term capital gains tax treatment is technically a year, right? A calendar year or 12 That's months right. of you owning the investment. So typically, when you think about investing into a startup, you're likely going to hit the long-term capital gains tax treatment because you're usually holding those shares or whatever the safe that you got or convertible note for a lot more than 12 months. For our investors, actually, though, I think we actually had one person that got hit with short-term capital gains tax treatment because they got in, you know, must have been like March of 2021 and sold the company in February 2022. So technically, they had it for like 11 months. So they technically should have claimed short-term capital gains tax treatment on their taxes. Do you know what the difference is in terms of like, is it short-term capital gains tax or just ordinary income?
So short-term taxes are, yes, ordinary income. So depending on how much you're making, that can vary from 0% if you're essentially making zero money, all the way up to, what is the highest tax bracket right now? 39.6%, I believe.
Yeah, it looks like it's 37% is the top tax bracket right now.
And what's the income required for that?
So for single filers, you're looking at 539K or more. For married filing jointly, you're looking at 648,000 about.
Let's say a brain surgeon or somebody that's clearly making more money than that. And you have an investment on the side and it gets bought and you buy it and sell it within 1 year, less than 1 year, then you're going to be paying close to 40% tax on it. So let's say that investment that you made, you made $1 million on it. 40% is going to go away in just IRS taxes. Federal taxes, right? So 40%, that's $400,000. You then layer on the state income tax if you happen to be in a California or New York or some other high state income tax state. And you're looking at probably another 10 to 12% that just goes away in taxes at least. So all of a sudden, more than half your gains are gone in taxes. If you sell or if you have an exit within 12 months. Now, if we flip that around and say if you hold on to it for more than 12 months, all of a sudden you get taxed at a little bit of a better rate from the IRS perspective. The state tax stays the same. You don't get any sort of discount on your California or New York state income tax. But on the IRS side, you're actually charged a maximum of 20% for long-term capital gains. And there's a sliding scale for that also, depending on what your income is. But going from 37, essentially 40% down to 20%, right, on $1 million exit, you're looking at saving an extra $200,000 in your pocket just by waiting potentially a couple extra weeks to hit that 1 year mark versus selling out a little bit too quickly. So this is one of those issues that paying attention to the details can have a profound impact on yourself.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that came up during the last election cycle was, will they increase the capital gains taxes to more like ordinary income levels, which if you're a venture capitalist or an angel investor, you know, going up to an ordinary income level for something that you're expecting to get hit 20% is a huge difference. And so it ended up not going through that legislation that was, you know, thrown out there as potentially a way, again, going back to kind of that debt ceiling that we had talked about a few weeks ago or a couple weeks ago, in trying to help with that is like, if you're a startup founder and you're selling a company and you get hit with an ordinary income tax on the acquisition, on the sale of that company, that really hurts the founder quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Thinking that you're going to have a 20% tax bill plus whatever your state in or your state capital gains tax treatment is, that's pretty painful. And I guess, let's talk a little bit about the state side of things, because where you live really makes a huge difference in kind of how these tax bills end up working out. So highest capital gains tax bill for the states, it has to be California, right? 14%.
Absolutely. 13.9%. They're looking at increasing that by an extra couple percentage points probably. But let's just stick with 13.9% for the current rate. I'm currently a California citizen. This is wild to pay. It's just kind of a fact of life. I am personally looking at moving to a different state, largely because of the tax situation. I mean, over 13% is just so much to pay. We just did an episode on buy, borrow, die. And like, that kind of makes me want to never sell an investment, even if it's a winner. I kind of like, if I make an angel investment, I kind of hope that they don't get acquired for a huge amount for a cash payout, but instead get acquired or go IPO, and I get to hold on to the shares and just never have to.
That's a great point. I never would have thought about that, actually. Yeah, especially if you believe in the company, just keep following them along as they, you know, they're post IPO. That's a great point, and just never pay the tax on it. Get that
exactly,
and then account, and then just borrow against it.
Right, and then just die one day and give them all over to my children.
Step up in basis.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right.
Yeah, just so like listeners can understand kind of how big of a swing those state capital gains taxes can be. So our primary residence for this last year and the last few years has been in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's capital gains tax treatment is 3.07%. So when you add that on to the 20% from the federal, it's only 23.07%, versus if you're in California and you hit that almost 34% coming right off the bat for long-term capital gains tax treatment. That's
right.
And so if you're hitting short-term, oh God, yeah. I mean, what would that be?
Oh then? Yeah, it's awful. It's basically 50%. Yeah.
It's half. Wow. Yeah. That's half your investment.
Right.
Why are venture capital firms based in the Bay Area? Are all of those partners just not in California technically? Like,
no,
I know
some
of the
Andreessen
guys
are.
Moved to Nevada technically.
I think a lot of people are still. Yeah. A lot of people are still based in California, and especially a lot of these employees that are paid very well, like the software engineers and things like that. A lot of them are based in California.
A lot of people are still based in California. But you also have a lot of corporations leaving California now because of the tax situation, right? So Elon Musk has, you know, transferred a lot of Tesla over to Texas. I know I just passed by their Gigafactory in Texas, which is huge. It is massive. And I think they actually just opened up like a lithium refinery in Texas, or they're going to. I think SpaceX, some of it's in Texas, some of it's in Florida, something like that. And there are a lot of other companies that are starting to move headquarters to tax-friendly places. Because when you think about it, California has easily the most number of unicorns in the country, right? Like it has to. And last year, California had a budget surplus that had to have been primarily from startup founders, right? Paying a tax treatment for the state.
Yeah, that was startups as well as just stock in larger companies, right? Like we were seeing all the SPACs, all the IPOs going public after COVID hit. So there was a massive amount of money that people made. Also, like your Google, your Facebook, your Apple stock just skyrocketed that year. So that's one of the big reasons why California was able to reap so much money. But also, if you think about it, like New York City, they're home to like the financial capital of the world, all the Goldman Sachs investment bankers, the Morgan Stanleys of the world, right? A lot of them are based in New York. And I think what's going on here is that very recently, we've seen technology come into play where it's starting to get a little bit easier working from other places. Historically, where you are is the type of people that you're able to associate yourself with, and better business deals and better companies will be able to be built when you're in person with the right people. Same thing with angel investing, right? You and I, we're not shy reaching out to people on LinkedIn and trying to get Zoom meetings to see if a potential investment makes sense or not. If you rewind 10 years ago, LinkedIn was not really a thing and Zoom calls were not a thing either, right? So in order to get into angel investments, you actually had to go and meet people at a coffee shop, talk to them in person, maybe even like going through physical slides that are printed out on pieces of paper in order to like network and make those deals happen. So when we fast forward 10 years from now, yeah, maybe Bay Area, New York cities might not be extreme hubs anymore. But I think in the past, there's good reason why they existed, that in order to like bump into the founder of Airbnb or whatever it is, you can't make that connection being in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, definitely true. I think that's why you're still going to have Silicon Valley be the primary hub within the US and even the world of innovation in just building technology companies. Because like you said, if you're trying to recruit artificial intelligence engineers, you're probably going to have an easier time doing that in the Bay Area versus being in Frisco, Texas or somewhere else, just because of the sheer number of talented people that are all in one location. The other thing that's really interesting, I recently heard on a podcast, was like the European startup ecosystem is pretty weak because of a lot of the regulatory hurdles that people have to jump through with like GDPR and stuff like that. Whereas in the US, we don't have as much regulatory hurdles to jump through, even though California is pushing through a lot of these privacy policies and things like that. But it's still just easier, I think, in the US ecosystem, which is great for startups and for innovation and technology, because if you start putting so many regulatory hurdles to jump through, you're going to limit and stifle innovation. And the US could lose its foothold of the primary innovator in the world, especially with other countries that are newly emerging as tech hubs throughout the world. So that's also an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of companies, countries, locations, however you want to categorize it, they have things called non-competes, where basically once you start working at one place, it's very difficult to go start your own company in that same industry or go join a competitor. And this makes things just non-competitive and naturally non-innovative. That's historically been one of the nice things about the Bay Area, is that it's so fluid. It's so easy to leave one company to go for another or to go do your own startup. There's very little handcuffs or just legal regulatory things getting in your way. That feels like it's starting to change a little bit, but that's been one of the big unlocks for the Bay Area compared to the rest of the country for why so many companies started in Silicon Valley and have thrived over there. Greg, going back to the taxes real quick, one other thing that I do want to talk about for the startup investing is that you actually can offset your losses against gains also. So a lot of times when people make an investment, they think, okay, I'm going to put in X amount of money and the most that I can lose is X amount of money. But actually, I don't think that that's true. I think it's a little bit less than X. Because if you're working a job, you're making other investments, right? You're going to have other income and gains that are coming in and you're going to be taxed on those. And if you lose, let's say, $100,000 for an angel investment that you made, it completely goes to zero. You can then take that $100,000 of loss and then offset it against some of your gains or income. And if you, let's just say you have an equivalent investment where you made $100,000, you otherwise would have been taxed at that, like we just talked about, 20-30%. So you would have given up $20,000-$30,000 of your gains. But if you have a loss that you can offset it against, all of a sudden you get to keep that full $20,000-$30,000 that would have otherwise gone in taxes. So I would actually say that if you make an angel investment for $100,000, yes, the maximum you can lose is $100,000. But even if the company goes down to zero, when you actually do the full math of it, you might only be down, call it $70,000. Any thoughts on that, Greg?
I mean, it's also what some companies have built their entire product around, right? Like Wealthfront and what Betterment, where one of their primary features is tax loss harvesting, which is really what you're talking about. But that's more specific for public companies where you can have a computer algorithm decide to sell your stock in Nike because it's down a certain percentage and it's going to cover your capital gains that you might have over here. So I think that is a great kind of caveat to throw out there. Like, you can still use that investment to your advantage, even if it does completely go to zero from the startup perspective. The other thing I want to throw out there is something called QSBS, which not a lot of people likely know about if you're not kind of investing in startups or building a company, but it's a very powerful tax exemption that exists. So what it does, and we're not going to go into the complete, this is what it means, and these are the requirements that it has to be. If you're interested, look it up. It's QSBS. You can find it basically anywhere online. But what it does is allows you to basically exempt some of those capital gains that you would have been paying if you meet some certain criteria. So there's actually like different types of companies that do not meet QSBS criteria. Most startups that you're investing in likely will. But the big caveat is you have to have held the stock or the shares of that company for 5 or more years, and it has to be an exit less than $50 million. So if you threw $100,000 in at a $5 million valuation and it sells for $50 million, you get it, and let's say they've never raised any of their money, you get a nice 10X on that investment. So let's say you have $1 million coming your way in capital gains. If you qualify, and if that company qualifies for QSBS, you actually don't pay anything in federal capital gains tax treatment. And so it's a nice exclusion, and it's a qualified small business stock. So it's just another advantage to investing in these riskier asset categories that the government says, look, we know these small businesses are super, super risky. And so we need to figure out a way to give people an advantage in saying, if we don't do something like this, maybe we have less investment going into private companies and it slows down the ecosystem a little bit. With this, it's just another advantage. If it does go off and exit in 5 years or more, you held it, you get a really nice basically 0% tax treatment. That's a great little handy thing to have. But if it's over $50 million acquisition, then I think it doesn't even count. So that kind of sucks. So if they sell for $52 million, I think that whole thing goes away.
Yeah, I think the real takeaway here is that there's a lot of interesting things around the tax treatment around both investments in general, but also startup investing specifically. And I think it's worthwhile doing a little bit of homework, especially if you are sitting on a nice gain, to see if there are any nice exemptions that you can take advantage of, to just make sure you're holding on to as much money as possible during an exit.
And I think this also qualifies too if you sell the stock on like a secondary marketplace as well. So keep that in mind. Like even if you, even if the company doesn't have an exit, but you want to get out of that stock for whatever reason, and you've held it for 5 years, technically you could sell that in secondary and get the same tax treatment as if it had exited, which is something that we should talk about in the future, is the secondary marketplaces for private companies. That was a quick conversation on taxes, short-term, long-term capital gains, QSBS. If you want to hear more about that kind of stuff, we can do some further episodes. Thanks for joining the Physician Syndicate podcast. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.